that music is, yes, from South Africa. It's a rallying song for both the end of apartheid and to cheer on teams in a football game. Now, I'm told that South Africa is preparing for the World Cup next month, and to lend some historical and political significance to the event, a film called The Team That Never Played has been made, looking at the collision of race and sport and politics during the apartheid era. Now, to discuss this online from Johannesburg with Morio Sanini. And Morio grew up at this time, and like so many, he played football. He's now with the South African Football Association, and sitting with me in the studio is Tony Barrell, no stranger to us. He's worked in both radio and telly as a writer and director. And both Tony and Morio were involved in the making of the doco, The Team That Never Played, and I welcome you both. Morio, during apartheid, South Africa was, of course, increasingly isolated from the rest of the world. Boycotts on oil, trade, financial dealings, cultural issues. But you would argue it was the boycott on sport that became South Africa's Achilles heel.
Yes, indeed. The majority of South Africans at the time, they decided that we can't have a normal sport in an abnormal society. And through sport boycott, they engaged international sports federations like, in the case of football, FIFA, the Olympic Committee, and many other sports federations.
These were the various expulsions from international sporting bodies, yeah?
Yes, indeed, because quite honestly, the system of apartheid were fought in different ways. But from a sporting perspective, that's when the liberation movements, sports bodies, you know, started engaging international sports federation to say that we can't have a normal sport into abnormal society. And as they said, we are prepared to make personal sacrifices and not participate in sport until the regime of apartheid is brought down.
Well, such was the insanity of apartheid that the national team, the national football team, was all white, but there was also a coloured league, an Indian league, and a black league.
Indeed, it was a very ridiculous situation, but I think it was the intended deliberate system by the government of the time to segregate people according to race. And it was not only a racial segregation, but it also, you know, reflected itself in terms of the allocation of resources. For instance, the White League was well-resourced. They were playing in beautiful plush pitches. They had fantastic facilities. The Indian League was slightly better. The Colored League, a bit better. And of course, when coming to the Black League, there was absolutely nothing. You have to play football. Even professional football at the time on a gravel ground, the little stadiums that they started building in the townships, you know, at least they will have a turf or so. But when you compare resources, it was chiss and chalk.
Tony, there's a great story in the doco about Jomo Sono, who played in the US. And when he comes back after the end of apartheid, he's made so much dosh in America that, well, you tell the story.
Well, actually, it wasn't even after the end of apartheid, he did it before. He bought a big white team. Mario could give us the real...
He
bought a white team. He played for the New York Cosmos team in the early 80s. Would that be right, Mario?
Late 70s, early 80s.
And he played alongside Pele. Pele played in that team. And he made so much money that when he came back to South Africa after he, you know, he reached his use-by date as a footballer, he became a businessman and he invested money in all sorts of different things and bought Highlands Park, was it?
Yes, Highlands Park.
Highlands Park, one of the top white teams.
It's a great yarn. Morio, in the doco, you talk about the rise of township football. Football played not in the stadiums but in the streets. Tell us why this was significant.
It was quite significant, but you know, it's very interesting what Tony Barrell was mentioning about Jomo Sono buying a white team coming back from the USA, because all the players, or the majority of the players, they decided to to demand free transfer. They said they can't play for a team that is owned by a black man.
Is that right?
And they started demanding transfers to another thing. But I mean, he had to, well, there were a few of them who remained. And he likes telling a story about one player who accosted him at the field and says he wants his clearance right now and then. And you get to understand at the time, it was still in the height of apartheid, and a black man was just seen as a slave, as a person who can hold a senior position within government, in business. And Jomo Sono decided to take a box of matches and wrote a clearance and says, if you want the clearance here on the field, then I'll give you a clearance. He took out a box of match and he wrote whatever thing that he wrote there and said, there you go, this is your clearance. But coming back to your question of a township football, I think at the time, black people, they were not, we were not allowed to play any sporting codes like your rugby, or it was played, but still there were no opportunities to can play for the Springboks, cricket as well. There were sporting codes that were just the reserves of white people, and quite obviously football was regarded as a black man's sport. But as people who are passionate about football, we played football, but it became an opportunity. It became an avenue to wage a struggle against apartheid, because at the time, having meetings, political meetings, it was outlawed. It was you couldn't have about 50 people or 100 people gathering without the security branch or the police, arresting people and stuff. So it was difficult. But during the matches, we used that particular opportunity to can relay political messages, and as well, it was an opportunity to can sing struggle songs, without being interfered with from the police. So it became not only entertainment for us, but it also became a very important political tool.
Tony, music was also important, wasn't it?
I think it's that thing about how township culture was its own thing in South Africa. That's where the majority of people were brought in to work, not just in the factories and the mines, but also in people's homes. But they always had to go back home there at night. So whatever happened in the townships, and music was one of the things that kept people going, as well as, well,
another great beans. Unifier,
but township culture was, a lot of it was in the street, because people's houses were, still are in many ways, very small and cramped, and big families living in them. So the street and playing in the street was essential to survival.
Mario, the idea for the documentary is based on a radio doco you did many moons ago, looking at the great South African football players who didn't receive the international recognition they would have had sanctions not been in place. Do you hope this documentary would in some way go towards rectifying that?
I think it will, and I think I was really blessed, because at the time I was just getting into the field of journalism, because, apartheid affected us in many ways. It was, some of us had to quit school because we were participating in the student representative councils, and because of student riots, you were hunted by the police. You had to run away to the rural areas and hide there. And sometimes they even circulate your names to the to the varsities and technicons and colleges to say this student is outlawed, he can't participate. So, when negotiations, at the multi-party democracy negotiations started, that's when some of us started, to go back to school. I mean, I went back to varsity at the age of 27 then to study journalism. And the reason why I chose journalism at the time, I just told myself I want to make a difference to my country. We have fought so hard, we have fought so long for democracy, we have lost so many people. They have been killed by the security police, by violence and all those sort of things. So it was an opportunity to make a contribution. I followed journalism, and I had an opportunity really in 1996 to work with the great documentary maker, Tony Barwell, as well as John Jacobs.
Yes, you landed on your feet there, getting Tony. There's no question of it. Now, Tony, the doco looks at three former football players during the apartheid era. There's a white bloke, a black player, and a coloured player. Tell us about Smiley Moussa, because he crossed the colour barriers.
Well, so did the white guy. But Smiley is an amazing character. like all South African footballers or township footballers, you get a nickname. And he's the only one I think I've come across who hasn't got a really kind of nickname that has to be explained. We'll have to talk to Mario about this a bit later. But he's called Smiley because that's his personality. It comes out, you know, even when he's playing serious football. But he did something quite remarkable.
Well, let's talk about where he stands
on the... He's a coloured person.
Okay. So his father was Indian, and his mother coloured.
Exactly. And he had a white father, I think. Anyway, he was restricted to playing for the coloured league. And like Mario was mentioning the different leagues. But he was so good that one of the white teams came up to him and said, look, you look pretty white, actually. You could pass, you know, you could pass as white. How about it? He was only a teenager. I think he'd be about 17 or 18 when this happened. So he said, all right, you know, I'll come and play for you. But everybody recognized him on the field straight away because of his footballing skill. They recognized who this player was. And after he came off, he scored couple of goals and they won and the team was very pleased, this Brea Park, and he got a call the next day or soon afterwards from the authorities saying, excuse me, are you Smiley Moussa? Yeah, okay, well, look, don't you turn up to that team again. You're not allowed to play in that league. You're not a white guy. But the irony is that he then got recruited to play for Crystal Palace or one of the English teams, and he got chucked out of England because his permit wasn't correct. So he ended up back in South Africa, but he played for a black team.
And an interesting point is made in your film, Tony, that there's little documentation about football being played during apartheid. But there are some great photos and footage in the film. Where did you get them? What archives did you pillage?
Well, I wish I knew more details about that, but our producer, Frances Green, she actually did a lot of research into where to get some beautiful photographs, particularly stills taken, black and white stills taken over a long period of time. She found a photographer who is actually still active, who had a fantastic portfolio of pictures and was able to fill in some of the gaps that otherwise wasn't there. There was no film of a lot of the games that we're talking about.
Mario, when apartheid ended, was the transition to multiracial teams easily made?
It became a bit challenging, but I think, you know, the fact that we had one of the greatest statesmen of all time, President Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela. I mean, for the man who has been incarcerated for 27 years and he comes out of prison and he preaches reconciliation, and he don't just preach reconciliation, but he demonstrates reconciliation. He went to the rugby finals in 1995 when the Springboks won the thing. I mean, he was there with the captain, Francois Pina. A great moment, a fantastic moment that really, you know, went the way to sort of bring reconciliation to the country. And subsequent to that, it was the Africa Cup of Nations in 1996. Obviously, football is played by the majority that is black people, but we had Neil Tovey as a captain as well of the team, and we won the Africa Cup of Nations in 1996. Still, President Mandela playing a very, very significant role. But obviously, there were challenges in terms of other sporting codes like your cricket itself, you know, even government tried to legislate in the form of a quota system. Rugby, it was a big, big challenge in terms of getting black people to participate. But yeah, I think we have made some very significant steps,
Tony,
in that direction.
Tony, fit Invictus into this saga for me. That's the Clint Eastwood film starring Morgan Freeman as Mandela. That's about the Rugby World Cup in 1995. What's the essential story in that that people found so inspirational?
Well, it's what Mario was just talking about. It's the fact that Mandela took an interest in what had been up to that point a whites-only game. And
so
if you think about it,
was his personal energy that...
I think so. And he crossed the barrier. And like most people outside South Africa, particularly in Australia and England, probably didn't think about football as anything but rugby and boycotts as anything but to do with either rugby or cricket. They didn't know about the boycotts of black by blacks against playing football with foreigners. So it's a sort of reverse sanctions that was working at the time. You know, not only did foreign teams not play with South Africa, South Africans refused to play with foreign teams, you know, black South Africans.
I suppose we could have a similar discussion about a number of other sports, Mario, in South Africa.
Yes, indeed. But I think, you know, the what the producer Francis Green has done through this program, the team that never played, or the documentary program, I think it just gives a perfect reflection of what really transpired. And I think it mirrors exactly what happened in other sporting codes. Because, like I said, there were pockets of rugby being played within the townships, but there were no resources. It was really difficult. And the same you can say about cricket. There were pockets of cricket, you know, still there were no resources. There were things like tennis, for instance. So sport was always there in black communities, but it's just that there was a deliberate policy to say you don't give the black communities the adequate resources. So the team that never plays, it really, really reflects that. But at the same time, I think it is so relevant at this point in time because people are, you know, we are being regarded currently. I'm talking about the South Africa Cinemas national team, Bafana Bafana. We're being regarded as underdogs in our own country when coming to this particular World Cup. But, you know, you hear football connoisseurs saying, if it wasn't of apartheid, the amazing talent that we have in this country, we were definitely going to win the World Cup. So I think it was just, you know, taking people down memory lane in terms of the silky skills.
We've got to wrap it, I'm afraid, Mario, but thanks for that. And Tony, where can our listeners see the doco?
Well, there's a premiere on at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image this Friday night, but I think that's a sort of invitation-only event. But later on, while the World Cup is on in July, it's going to be shown on ABC television one Sunday night.
Splendid. Mario Sanyani from the South African Football Association, Tony Barrell, doco writer and director of the film, The Team That Never Played, and we'll put up details on our webpage. And don't forget, you can comment on LNL's stories on our website, abc.net.au/rn/late-night-live, and click on the story you want to talk about. On our next, I'll be talking to Ben Hills, one of the great investigative journalists of Australian history, about the golden age of journalism when a bloke called Graham Perkin, widely regarded to be the best newspaper editor Australia ever produced, was at the helm of The Age in Melbourne. And boy, did our journalism go through some fundamental changes. That's it for now. Stick around for the news on Radio National, and we'll see you later.